Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts. Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where? Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right. Let's go.
Excellent. Let us go. Hello, I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kyle Risdahl. It is Tuesday. We are going to do a single topic today. The National Football League is on the agenda. Not as the NFL would probably hope about the Super Bowl this coming weekend. Go Rams, by the way. Although, you know, I kind of like Joe Burrow. I kind of like him a lot. I don't know. Anyway.
You know how I feel about the Rams.
I know you do. I know you do. That's a whole St. Louis thing. We're going to get to that. The other reason the NFL is in the news, and it has been for most of last week, and it continues into this week, is the lawsuit filed by the recently fired head coach of the Miami Dolphins, Brian Flores, who was alleged, among some other things, that the league fundamentally racially discriminates against black coaches. So we're going to talk about that.
Right. This isn't just a labor story. It's also about power and money with major financial implications for the NFL. But of course, at the heart of it is this legacy of systemic racism and what happens when you, unfortunately, are the person who feels the responsibility to try to dismantle that. And here to make us smart about the topic is Jeremy Duru, a professor of sports law at American University, an author of the book Advancing the Ball, Race Reformation, and the Quest for Equal Coaching Opportunity in the NFL. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you all.
So explain for us, if you don't mind, the broad strokes about what this lawsuit is for and has alleged and what's happening inside the NFL.
Sure. So Brian Flores is alleging racial discrimination with respect to coaching and executive opportunities in the National Football League. It's a class action. So he's bringing the action on behalf of a class of African-Americans who are candidates for coaching and executive positions generally. And he alleges, he sets forth statistics that should be shocking to those who seek equal opportunity, but won't be shocking to those who are familiar with the NFL's history. So, you know, it's, the average tenure of a black head coach is 2.5 years. The average tenure of a white head coach is 3.5 years. After a winning season, a black coach is 25% likelihood of being terminated. For a white coach, 6%. White coaches get a second chance more frequently than black coaches. The numbers are consistent. They indicate double standards. They indicate headwinds. What's surprising about this particular suit is that you have somebody who is in the peak of their career, having just won two, posted back-to-back winning seasons with the Dolphins, is sought after, it would seem, among other clubs, and he's stepping up, potentially risking his career, to bring the issue to light.
Couple of things, Professor. I mean, this is such a, it's a horrible topic, but it's so interesting. Super quick, it's a class action lawsuit. Doesn't that mean he, Mr. Flores, needs other people harmed by the NFL to sign up? And what do you think the likelihood of that is? Because it's arguably a career-ending move, right, to get on this lawsuit, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yes, it's arguably a career-ending move to be on this lawsuit if you're Flores or anybody who wants to join the class. And let me say just very quickly that Flores does want to coach. He loves to coach. Yeah. He says he's built to coach. He wants to coach. So if this does end his career, it's a tragedy. It's unfortunate for him and for the league because he's an excellent coach. But to your question, yes, it's a class action, meaning that other people have to join the class for it to go forward as a class action. And the many requirements of a class action under Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and one of those is numerosity. So you have to have a certain number of people. The threshold is usually around 40. And so if we don't get numerosity, then it's not that his claim will totally be extinguished, but it'll move forward as an individual claim and not a class claim. And, you know, there is strength in numbers. I think as an individual claim, he'll be weaker moving forward. But we have yet to see if other people are going to join his action.
Mm-hmm. We should mention here that all the teams named in the lawsuit and the NFL have denied these allegations. But draw that through line for us between what we're seeing now with Brian Flores' lawsuit and Colin Kaepernick's story and the NFL's record on race. The league is a majority black players, but there's some real discrepancies when you get to the top.
Yeah, and allow me to say, you know, 20 years ago, there was a study done out of the University of Pennsylvania. A labor economist named Janice Madden studied win-loss records comparing black coaches and white coaches going back 15 years from 2001, so going back to 1986. And during that period of time, black coaches in their first season with the club won 3.7 games per season. White coaches similarly did worse as a comparative matter in the years in which coaches were terminated. And overall, black coaches won more games. So those statistics existed then. The statistics that I read off to you earlier in this conversation from the Flores complaint exist now. And speaking of a straight line running through, a straight line has run through from then to now with respect to headwinds in the National Football League with respect to people of color. You raised Colin Kaepernick, a different issue, but certainly a concern about whether the league is committed to the ability of their athletes to express themselves with respect to systemic discrimination. So the league really has been beset with challenges on this front. And you know, the light at the end of the tunnel doesn't seem to be there. And we've seen some progress, but we've also seen some backtracking. And where we were when Brian Flores brought his suit with one African-American coach of color in a league where you have 32 clubs, you know, is a real, real substantial problem. I think Brian probably couldn't take it anymore, and he decided to challenge the league in court.
The thing about the Colin Kaepernick comparison, though, while completely true and legit, is this. The league has effectively blackballed Colin Kaepernick since he took the knee. There have been no repercussions for the league substantive repercussions that I'm aware of. It's a $10 billion a year enterprise at a national level, run by a bunch of old white guys, and yet it's still doing land office business.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The National Football League is, you know, truly is a juggernaut. And it seems as if it will always be, no matter what. I mean, we're talking about these issues here, but, you know, we could go back and talk about issues that have dogged the league with respect to hostile work environments, sexual harassments, so many different issues that you would think might negatively impact or maybe sink an enterprise. And it's not been the case with the National Football League. It has proven very, very resilient. Now, one reason that I think it's been able to be resilient, it is generally viewed its employees, players, coaches, as unwilling to take the career risk of challenging them publicly and challenging them in court. And I think what we've seen over the course of the last several years is that maybe that calculation has to change. Maybe players, coaches are more and more willing to take a shot at the league publicly and perhaps legally. Maybe that will change the league's calculus when it thinks about how wants to run its operation going forward.
You mentioned that if Brian Flores can't get enough people to join his class, he has to go it on its own, and that's harder. And can you talk as an attorney about why it's so hard to prove structural and systemic racism on an individual level, but even at a class level?
Sure. So we'll talk about the individual level first, because I think it's most stark in that regard. So the league-wide statistics that we've been talking about in this conversation are just that. They are league-wide. And if you are an individual and you are bringing suit with respect to a particular incident, in this case, the principal incident is Brian Flores' allegation that he was discriminated against by the New York Giants when they failed to seriously consider him for the head coaching position. When you are bringing an individual case with respect to a particular incident, you can't leverage those nationwide stats, league-wide stats, because those don't bear directly on the Giants. You have to bring facts that relate directly to the Giants. And the question is, can Brian Flores allege those? As you've pointed out, the league has denied, and the Giants have denied Flores' allegations. Flores will have to show that the text that Belichick, that Bill Belichick sent him, the indication that he was essentially not a real candidate when he went to his interview because someone else would be hired, he has to show that that's because of race. And the text alone doesn't necessarily reveal that that's about race. So Flores is going to have to make the argument that indeed the experience he had in New York was about race and not just about the Giants preferring someone else and moving quickly on someone else.
We should be clear here that this text exchange that Belichick had with Flores was Belichick getting confused in a mistaken case of identity and in the Brian Flores perspective, letting the cat out of the bag that it was a done deal and he was never going to even be considered for this job because it was sealed up. Let me ask you this, though, Professor. Now what happens with this case?
So a couple of things. Flores needs to get class certification. This goes to the class point we made previously. If the numbers aren't there and potentially for other reasons, he doesn't get class certification, then as I mentioned, it becomes an individual case. In either event, the next big decision note that will be presented to a court is whether indeed Flores will be able to survive the defendant's inevitable motion to dismiss. You're always going to get a motion to dismiss from a defendant, a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted. That's going to come at Brian Flores. He's going to have to surmount that. He's going to have to show that he has a strong enough case that he should be able to get to the stage of litigation called discovery, which comes after the motion to dismiss. And discovery is the stage where you get to look into all of the other side's documents related to your lawsuit and basically see what they've got. And those are the documents that Flores will marshal in making his ultimate case. The issue is, can he get there? Right. And he only gets to that information if he can get back, get past the motion to dismiss that the league and the clubs will certainly file.
And how high is that bar on the motion to dismiss? I mean, give me a sense.
It can be tough to get past it. It can be tough to get past it. He'll have to show that there is at least the possibility that he can make out a race discrimination claim and not just a, hey, we wanted someone else claim.
Yeah.
Stepping back a little bit, there in theory, and I say that with like giant air quotes, a system in place to help end discrimination at the top levels of the NFL, the Rooney Rule, which has been around for a while. And it's also a practice that many companies have adopted to try to increase diversity, often to the same effect. Why hasn't, first of all, can you explain what the Rooney Rule is and why it hasn't worked for the NFL or in many other places?
Sure. I'm really glad you asked that question. So the Rooney Rule says that you have to interview one person of color before making a hire for a particular position. In the NFL context, The Rooney Rule says you have to interview now. It's been amended. You have to interview two people of color when making a decision as to who's going to be your next coach, next head coach. It also applies in the general manager context and with respect to offensive, defensive, and special teams coordinator. So the idea, the theory behind the rule is, you know, we want to get people into that interview room who otherwise wouldn't get in, who historically have not gotten in. Let them into the room and give them a chance to make the case that they're right for the job. I think it's a sound theory. I think it's a sound approach to pursuing equal opportunity. The problem is that in this NFL context, and you mentioned other corporations implement the rule, and they do, and some of them have the same problem, but certainly in the NFL context, individual clubs make the hiring decisions, and individual clubs are, on the whole, not implementing the rule properly. That is to say, they're in some cases conducting sham interviews, in other cases simply not taking the candidates of color seriously. And when that has happened, the National Football League has not come down on the club for doing that. The commissioner has the authority to penalize violations of the rule, and we've not seen such a penalty in nearly two decades. And so what's the consequence? Well, the consequence is other clubs say, well, this isn't a rule that the league is that serious about. You know, we see so-and-so club did this and that. They didn't seem to be true to the rule, so maybe I'm not going to worry about the rule either. And then we have a backslide, and that is what I think we've seen. So I think the Rooney Rule itself is sound in concept. The way in which it's been implemented is the failure.
It's fascinating that you say that the Rooney Rule is sound in concept, because this has been implemented in so many other parts of the economy. And I wonder if there's if you have any concern that watching it be so ineffective at the NFL has any impact for people leaning on it in other industries.
It's a big concern. It's a big concern because people in these other industries brought the Rooney Rule to their industries because they saw it in the NFL. And so if you have the place where the rule was essentially born falling down in the job with respect to implementing the rule, then there's going to be less confidence in the rule elsewhere. So I think it's up to these corporations, these companies, these entities, both public and private, that are implementing the rule to look at what's happening in the NFL, look at what have been the failings, look at the failure to implement, look at the failure to enforce, and make sure that doesn't happen in their organizations, or they may find themselves in the same situation in which the NFL sits now.
Jeremy Duru, professor of sports law at American University, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good stuff, Professor. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you both. Pleasure to be with you.
Man. I'll tell you, it's a good story. It's detailed. It's interesting. It's terrible. It's why are we still watching football? It's all of that stuff, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, as somebody who doesn't watch football, I can just think of so many people I know in journalism and elsewhere who constantly complain about going in for interviews. Yeah. And they're like, oh, yeah, that was just one of those interviews where they had to interview a black person. And right. I know I'm not getting that job. And that's demoralizing.
Yeah.
It really is.
And it's exactly what he was talking about at the end there. It's the Rooney Rule mm-hmm. brought to other professions, and the failure of it is corrosive.
Yeah, but I'd be very fascinated to see if he gets the people he needs for the class action.
Well,
because
so, yes,
that's hard.
That's what I was going to say. I don't know that there are 40 people. Certainly there haven't ever been 40 black head coaches in the United States in the National Football League, let alone general managers, right? So I think he's got a population problem, you know?
Well, I mean, I think you could tap into all the people who've been qualified for those jobs but didn't get a chance.
Yeah.
That pool's probably much bigger than
huge.
You could ever imagine.
It's huge, but then you have to prove the negative. I mean, so one of the real problems with this thing is you have to prove that racial component in that text exchange with Bill Belichick, right? And when mm-hmm. you read it, it's Belichick being a moron for a lot of reasons, but it doesn't. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Are you going to watch the Super Bowl?
I am. Yeah, I am. I am. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, well, send us your thoughts, would you, on this, on the Super Bowl, whether you ought to watch or whether or not. Anything you want to say to us. Our number is 508-827-6278, 508-82-SMART. Leave us a voice memo if you like. Make me smart at marketplace.org. We're coming right back.
I feel badly for putting you on the spot about the Super Bowl because, I'm really just not watching because I'm petty.
Well, we'll get to the St. Louis portion of the conversation later, I think. Yes. There's a listener letter coming. No, I look. Yeah. And whatever. Anyway, so we got some news.
News
fix. You go first.
Go. It.
No, you go.
Oh, yeah, because I'm on the sports theme.
Yes.
So I have not really been watching the Olympics like nonstop. I've been watching little videos of different mm-hmm. things sort of as they come across my timeline. And I came across the story of Eileen Gu, who's mm-hmm. a skier. And they have this new sport in the Olympics this year, free ski big air. And I didn't even know this was a thing. And I looked at this and I was like, well, you know, so the story of Eileen Gu is a really important and interesting one that I'm going to get to. But also, I saw that ramp and literally shuddered.
Yeah, I'm not going off that thing. Kidding me?
Gosh, that is so scary. And as somebody who has had like pretty ugly like accidents in my attempts to ski. I'm not there for it. But anyway, Eileen Gu won the gold in the first free ski big air competition in the Olympics by landing two of basically the hardest tricks you can. And for people who've never seen this, there's a giant ramp and you go down this ramp and then you flip up into the air and do acrobatic tricks in the air mm-hmm. and then you land and hopefully don't die. And of course, you know, they don't because they're professionals. And it was really scary. But anyway, so she was in a really... Eileen Gu was born in the U.S. and born in California, but she's competing for China mm-hmm. And was in very, very close race with the candidate from France. She beat her out at the last minute. If you watch when she lands the final jump, which is sort of the contest defining jump, and she realizes that she nailed it. You have one of those just like Olympic moments where the athlete knows they have it. And, you know, the crowd goes nuts for whatever crowd is there. Anyway, it's a nice moment. Eileen Gu is somebody who is dealing with a lot of noise around her. Mm-hmm. Like, over why she's competing for China instead of the United States, the pressure of that. She's also a musician and apparently a model and doing all these other things. And they're... People have clearly attempted to make her something of a political object in the tensions between the U.S. and China and these political dynamics. Yeah. And so the article that I linked to is this sort of commentary piece in the Washington Post about how she's just kind of pushed out all that noise and is doing her own thing. And I cannot imagine, you know, being that athletic and doing something like that, but doing something like that with all of that happening around you.
And she's like 19 or something. I mean, she's, you know, she's like, it's like, are you kidding me? Yeah.
Yeah. So if you haven't watched that, I need to go back and watch the ice skating.
Oh, you do.
I believe you do. Yeah. I saw that there was supposed to be a really amazing ice skating
Nathan Chen did it. It was amazing.
Yes. Nathan Chen. Yeah, that's what I want to watch. I want to go and watch that. Yeah. I heard that was amazing.
Yeah, it was really good.
So yeah, you know, it's funny. I wish that our sports were not so fraught.
Yeah.
you know? I feel so sad sometimes that these people work so hard. And Colin Kaepernick was like this. These are people who work so hard to get where they are mm-hmm. and to do what they do. And it ends up getting clouded or in Colin Kaepernick's case, destroyed by politics and racism and mm-hmm. things. And anyhow.
Yeah.
All right, what's your news?
Okay, so I've got two in there. I'm just going to go with one because the other one just bugs me. This Canada thing is amazing. So I lived in Ottawa for 2 years. Lovely little sleepy little Canadian town, which
what
has now been shut
down
by truckers who are upset over vaccine mandates from the Canadian government. And when I say shut down, they have literally parked these 18-wheelers in the middle of town, and they're blaring horns and shooting off fireworks. And it's amazing. It's just, I can't even tell you how crazy that is. But that's not why I want to mention this. Why I want to mention this is because today, and I guess it started last night, those Canadian truckers have shut down the Ambassador Bridge, which leads from Windsor, Ontario to Detroit, Michigan. Something like, yes, 1.5 million trucks pass through Detroit to and from Canada every single year. This is the longest undefended border in the world. $1 billion worth of trade goes through the Canadian-U.S. border every single day in normal times. And now these truckers are shutting down an enormous part of it. And it's just kind of wild. It's a manifestation of 2 years of pandemic. It's a manifestation of vaccine mandates. It's frustration. It's these workers, these truckers having some power. It's kind of crazy. And they've shut down this huge, huge, huge economic lifeline for both countries. Wild. Just wild.
It is wild. This story first came onto my radar actually a couple of weeks ago because I was on the BBC and they were talking about oh, the Canadian truckers. And I was just like, what? And so I was surprised to see that you brought it up. But then I was like, oh my gosh, it's still going on. And the issue back when we were talking about on the BBC was that sort of the alt-right influences filtered into it.
Yes, and QAnon is up there, the whole deal,
A lot of the same people who were, stirring things up around January 6th are, getting in the middle of this. And, it's one thing when you're messing with, a city and its operation, but when you start affecting trade between two countries, does that then it becomes an international issue.
Yes.
I wonder now if the U.S. is going to feel the need to somehow get involved and what that might look like.
Yeah, totally could be.
Crazy. Worth watching. Okay.
All right. Mailbag. Let's go.
Yes.
Hi, Make Me Smart team.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, fair enough. So last week we talked about Tesla a little bit and the software glitch that let 50,000 of those cars roll through stop signs when the car is in full auto drive mode. And here's what we got.
Hi, my name is Rich, and I am calling from my adopted hometown of St. Louis, Missouri. And I cannot believe that Kimberly Adams didn't take the opportunity to say, oh, well, then this malfunctioning Teslas will be right at home in St. Louis. when I moved here years ago, I learned some things right away about St. Louis. Everyone asks you what high school you went to. Toasted ravioli is a delicacy. And nobody stops at stop signs. It is because they're on every single intersection in town, it seems like. Anyway, thanks for keeping me smart.
I didn't know St. Louis had so much going on. Holy cow.
It's quite the town.
Wow.
Yeah, it's funny, but it's not because, there's a lot of, I hate to bring it down because it's kind of a funny note, but there's a lot of racial discrimination in policing in St. Louis and the surrounding areas, which I don't have to tell anyone who's been around for the Black Lives Matter movement. But rolling stops are such a common way that you get pulled over. And who gets pulled over for rolling stops has traditionally been a thing. Now, I'm relying on my experience when I lived in St. Louis when I was much, much younger. So perhaps this has changed and they've fixed that issue. But I know that my parents and all the parents of my friends, of all of my Black friends, they were adamant that we fully stop at every single stop sign because they were like, that's how you're going to get pulled over by the cops. Part of the talk.
Yep.
But yes, but most, for the most part, people get away with the rolling stops when they can. in St. Louis. Yes, that is a true thing. All right. Last week, we also talked about inflation, and we got this from Jeff in Austin.
I work in higher ed, and all this talk about like wages are going up, wages are going up, wages are going up. I don't know if it's just where I work, but we're not seeing that. And I definitely see a lot of job loss, but they just are trying to replace it at the exact same like salary level or even lower in some cases. I think the inflation thing is very troubling for those of us that are stuck in positions that are not dependent on producing something. We're not going to get a raise because we produced more students who got degrees, things like that. Anyway, love the show. You guys keep making us smart. Thanks.
Yeah, no, Jeff, you're not going to get a raise because you're producing more students who got degrees. And white-collar workers in general, that's not where the pay increases are coming, right? The pay increases are coming in the lower income spectrum, right? The lower part of the wage scale, blue-collar service industry jobs, not folks who are in offices and stuff like that. So that's exactly right. That's what's happening. And, of course, then those wage gains at the bottom are being taken back by inflation, which comes out on, what is today, Tuesday, comes out on Thursday, the next CPI, and it's going to actually bump up a little bit from 7%. So, yeah, the story's not going away, but it's not you and your colleagues, Jeff, who are getting those raises, for sure.
Although he did say they're seeing a lot of losses.
Yeah.
After a little while, they're not going to be able to hire at those same wages or less, right. And then eventually it'll catch up to them or not. Yeah. Who knows?
Who knows?
All right.
Diane in San Antonio sent us an email. Here's what she says. I really missed the live stream on Fridays. Hope it comes back soon.
Uh-oh, Diane, you are in luck. We do have some news. The live stream, for those of you who watch on Fridays on YouTube, will be back. It's coming back this Friday. So, yay, I'll come up with a fun cocktail.
Who's on with you? I know I've been off a lot of Fridays lately, and I'm off again this Friday, actually, because I'm having knee surgery because I'm an old man. Who's on with you on Friday? Oh, it's all right.
I don't know.
You don't know? All right. Well, we'll figure it out. I'll listen and I'll learn.
Tell us in a second.
I'll listen and I'll learn.
Megan McCarty-Carino is going to be on with us.
All right.
Oh, good luck with your surgery.
Yeah.
Oh, and so Diane says that her grandfather had a bourbon at 5 p.m. every day, and he called it a fivesies. So it's appropriate that every Friday at 5:30, she and her husband make a drink and watch the live stream. Okay, well, that just tells me
They're
I need to have
a,
some kind of bourbon
drink.
Got it. Bet.
Oh, man. It's like you're adaptable. It's so good. Bourbon? Sure. Bourbon. Whatever. Midori? Sure. Midori. Whatever. All right. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
No, not Midori. And we're going to leave you with today's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about?
This is Rob from Alameda, California. Something I once thought I knew is that I can't stomach live-action superhero movies. I mean, Iron Man isn't aerodynamic, so how does he fly? And where does he store all the fuel that is coming out of his boots? What I have discovered is a rich collection of complex characters who reveal their humanity in every film, even the non-humans. The characters are flawed, vulnerable, and even fight amongst themselves until the bad guy returns. All I can say about Captain America's Civil War is wow. The tension between Tony Stark and Steve Rogers is palpable. And flipping the script, putting Stark in the right and Rogers in the wrong, priceless.
He's got rockets.
I guess we should have said spoiler alert.
Yeah, right? He's got rockets Spoiler in his alert. Shoes and his arms and his hands. He doesn't. It's like nuclear powered or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it comes from his heart thing, and that shifts power. That's the fuel source.
There you go. Learn something new every day on this podcast.
And that's why it doesn't have to be aerodynamic. I mean, have you seen like some of America's military?
Yeah,
like,
right.
As you know, Kai, some of those planes are not the helicopters are not the sleekest things in the world.
That is true.
They somehow get in the air.
As does Iron Man. All right. When you are done listening to this podcast, well, you can listen again if you want to, but do us a favor and send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question. You can leave us a voice message at our number. It's 508-UB-SMART, or you can just do it in an email, makemesmart@marketplace.org.
That's it for today. Mariel Segura and Megan McCarty-Carino will be answering your questions tomorrow for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. If you have questions you want answered, you can send them to us with that information that Kai just gave us.
Just because. It's easier that way.
Just because. I'm not saying it again.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, goodness. What's the clunkiest thing you ever read? Sorry. got distracted.
Oh, I don't know. Good question. Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our team also includes producer Marquette Green, Ellen Rolfes. She writes our newsletter, and our intern, who is Tiffany Bowie.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe with mixing by Becca Weinman. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is a director of On Demand, and Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
I got an email from Ben Tolliday the other day. He's doing well.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I see his stuff on Instagram sometimes.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, him and Daniel too, actually.
Yeah. Aw, nostalgia.
Yeah.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.